From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to a special Thanksgiving edition of Washington Watch. Last month, my wife and two of our children had a unique experience of having Thanksgiving dinner with friends at Lot Number 1 in Plymouth, Massachusetts, about 400 yards from Plymouth Rock. It's believed to be the location of the first Thanksgiving in the fall of 1621. As we had dinner, I thought about the Pilgrims and what they had endured to get to that first Thanksgiving. Their first winter was devastating. Nearly half of the 102 Pilgrims, 47 to be exact, died during the winter. 13 out of 18 of the wives died. Only three families remained unbroken by death that first winter. The late Peter Marshall wrote in The Light and the Glory, quote, "These were not like other men. The more adversity mounted against them, the harder they prayed, never giving in to despair, to murmuring, to any of the petty jealousies that split and divide," end quote. What motivated them to face and overcome such difficulties? It was for and by their faith. They came to this new world not for the freedom of worship alone, but to live by their faith and teach their children to do the same. Their leader, William Bradford, wrote this, quote, "A great hope and inward zeal they had of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way thereunto for the propagating and advancing the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world. Yea, though they should be, but yet even stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work," end quote. They did it for the faith, and it was from that faith in Jesus Christ that they drew their strength. For over a half a century, there has been an unrelenting attack on religion in America, an all-out effort to drive religion from public life, relegating it to the recesses of society. This assault on religion was launched in tandem with the sexual revolution, the attack on morality. Today, America's schools are at the epicenter of this assault on morality, pushing an ideology that not only denies morality, but all truth, including the self-evident truth of biology. Now, this focus on America's school children in the advance of this immorality should not surprise anyone, as the classroom was made ready for this back in 1962 and 63, when religion and prayer and the Bible were removed from the classroom by the Supreme Court. Now, this is why I focus so much on religious freedom, the ability to not just believe in God, but to live our lives according to the truth of Scripture in such a way as to influence the world around us. Now, I thought it appropriate today to play for you a speech made by the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, at the Notre Dame Law School. In my opinion, it is one of the most significant speeches on the essential nature of religious freedom, the nature of the assault on this first freedom, and why it is essential we must defend it. Here is Attorney General William Barr.
When my daughter, Meg, after she graduated and ultimately went to law school, she became very ill for a period of time. And I knew there were great kids at Notre Dame, people of great character, and for a long period of time, there was always one of her classmates visiting us. They worked it out, so there was always someone coming to visit us while she was being treated in the hospital and so forth, and we got very close to all her friends, and we love them to death, and Notre Dame will always have a special place in my heart because of that. I have five grandchildren now with another on the way, and I'd be very proud if they all end up at Notre Dame. Meg, incidentally, recovered and got married recently. She got married on December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And the day before, I got a call from the president, who was walking out to the helicopters, and he said, "Bill, I know we talked about putting the announcement off until after your daughter's wedding, but I'd sort of like to do it today if it's okay with you, but it's totally up to you." And I said, "Well, Mr. President, we talked about it, and whatever suits you, you know, we'll adjust to. That'll be fine." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll do it now while I'm walking out to the helicopters." So I turned on the, I was, you know, lounging around in my study at home, and I turned on the television, and it was sort of the first of a number of out-of-body experiences I've had since then, because he walks over, he goes, I'm selecting Bill Barr to be Attorney General of the United States. And that was the day before, that was Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, and the next day was my daughter's wedding, and she said to me, Pop, you're the only guy I know who would upstage his daughter at his own, at her wedding. But when I gave the toast, I said, you know, Meg, it's okay, because just as the Barr name is going to be dragged through the mud, you're changing your name to McGaughy. Today, I would like to share some thoughts with you about religious liberty in America. It's an important priority in this administration and for this Department of Justice. We've set up a task force within the department in which all the various components that have equities in this area, the Solicitor General's Office, the Civil Division, the Office of Legal Counsel, and other offices are all represented. And we have regular meetings, and we keep an eye out for cases or events around the country where states are misapplying the Establishment Clause in a way that discriminates against people of faith, or cases where states adopt laws that impinge upon the free exercise of religion. From the founding era onward, there was strong consensus about the centrality of religious liberty in the United States. The imperative of protecting religious freedom was not just a nod in the direction of piety. It reflects the framers' belief that religion was indispensable to sustaining our free system of government. In his renowned 1785 pamphlet, Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, James Madison described religious liberty as a right towards men, but a duty towards the Creator, and a duty precedent both in order of time and degree of obligation to the claims of civil society. It has been over 230 years since that small group of colonial lawyers led a revolution and launched what they viewed as a great experiment, establishing a society fundamentally different than anything that had come before. They crafted a magnificent charter of freedom, the United States Constitution, which provides for limited government while leaving the people broadly at liberty to pursue their lives both as individuals and through their free associations. This quantum leap in liberty has been the mainspring of unprecedented human progress, not only for Americans, but for people around the world. In the 20th century, our form of free society faced a severe test. There's always been the question whether a democracy so solicitous of individual freedom could stand up against the regimented totalitarian state. That question was answered with a resounding yes as the United States stood up against and defeated first fascism and then communism. But in the 21st century, we face an entirely different kind of challenge. The challenge we face is precisely what the founding fathers foresaw would be the supreme test of a free society. They never thought that the main danger to the republic would come from external foes. The central question was whether, over the long haul, we the people could handle freedom. The question was whether the citizens in such a free society could maintain the moral discipline and virtue necessary for the survival of free institutions. By and large, the founding generation's view of human nature was drawn from the classical Christian tradition. These practical statesmen understood that individuals, while having the potential for great good, also had the capacity for great evil. Men are subject to powerful passions and appetites, and if unrestrained, are capable of ruthlessly riding roughshod over their neighbors and the community at large. No society can exist without some means of restraining individual rapacity. But if you rely on the coercive power of the government to impose those restraints, the framers believed, this would inevitably lead to a government that is too controlling, and you would end up with no liberty, just tyranny. On the other hand, unless you had some effective restraint, you end up with something equally dangerous: licentiousness, the unbridled pursuit of personal appetites at the expense of the common good. This is just another form of tyranny, where the individual is enslaved by his appetites and the possibility of any healthy community life crumbles. Edmund Burke summed up this point in his typically colorful language. Men are qualified for civil liberty in exact proportion to their disposition to put chains upon their own appetites. Society cannot exist unless a controlling power be placed somewhere. And the less of it there is within, the more of it there must be without. It is ordained in the eternal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters. So the founders decided to take a gamble, and they called it a great experiment. They would leave the people broad liberty, they would limit the coercive power of the government, and they would place their trust in the self-discipline and virtue of the American people. In the words of Madison, "We have staked our future on the ability of each of us to govern ourselves." And this is really what they meant by self-government. It did not mean primarily the mechanics by which we select a representative legislature. It referred to the capacity of each individual to restrain and govern themselves. But what was the source of this internal controlling power? In a free republic, those restraints could not be handed down from above by philosopher kings. Instead, social order must flow up from the people themselves, freely obeying the dictates of inwardly possessed and commonly shared moral values. And to control willful human beings with an infinite capacity to rationalize, those moral values must rest on authority independent of men's wills. They must flow from the transcendent supreme being.
You're listening to a special edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. This has been William Barr, the Attorney General of the United States, who recently gave a speech on religious freedom, the essential nature of religious freedom to America's republic, the attack that is taking place on religious freedom. And we'll continue as he talks about what we must do to defend this essential freedom. To find out more about Washington Watch and about the Family Research Council and about what you can do, go to TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. Coming right back.
Did you know that Family Research Council just published a new series on forming a biblical worldview? In these publications, David Clawson, Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview at FRC, addresses the complex moral questions and issues prevalent in our society today. Clawson discusses the biblical basis behind these moral issues and urges Christians to stand firm on the foundational truths of the Bible. Today, there is widespread biblical illiteracy. Americans are unaware of what the Bible says, and even professing Christians have difficulty defending a biblical ethic. As a result, Christian beliefs are increasingly dismissed as outdated or even seen as hateful. The Biblical Worldview series seeks to bridge this gap by solidifying Christians in their biblical worldview so they are ready to give an answer for the hope that is in them. The first three publications in this series discuss the biblical and historical basis for life, religious liberty, and political engagement. To learn more, visit frc.org/worldview.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to a special edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. The website, tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at tperkins. Today, as I said, a special edition, something we've never done before, airing a speech not given at an FRC-related event. This is actually the Attorney General of the United States, who recently spoke to the Notre Dame Law School about religious freedom. Here we pick up his speech at Notre Dame.
In short, in the framers' view, free government was only suitable and sustainable for a religious people, a people who recognized that there was a transcendent moral order antecedent to both the state and to man-made laws, and had the discipline to control themselves according to those enduring principles. As John Adams put it, we have no government armed with the power which is capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other. And as Father John Courtney Murray observed, the American tenet was not that free government is inevitable, only that it is possible, and that its possibility can be realized only when the people as a whole are inwardly governed by the recognized imperatives of the universal moral order. Well, how does religion promote moral discipline and the virtue needed to sustain free government? Well, first, it gives us rules to live by. The founding generation were Christians, and they believed that the Judeo-Christian moral system corresponds to the true nature of man. And those rules speak to man and fulfill man both in his private spiritual life and in his communal life. Those moral precepts start, of course, in Christianity with the two great commandments, to love God with your whole heart, soul, and mind, and to love thy neighbor as thyself. But they also include the guidance of natural law, a real transcendent moral order which flows from God's eternal law, the divine wisdom by which the whole of creation is ordered. The eternal law is impressed upon and reflected in all created things. And from the nature of things, we can, through reason and experience, discern standards of right and wrong that exist independent of human will. Now, modern secularists dismiss this idea of morality as sort of otherworldly superstition imposed by a killjoy clergy. But in fact, Judeo-Christian moral standards are the ultimate utilitarian rules for human conduct. They reflect the rules that are best for man, not in the by and by, but in the here and now. They are like God's instruction manual for the best running of man and the best operation of human society. And by the same token, violations of these moral laws have bad real-world consequences for man and for society. We may not pay the price immediately, but over time, the harm is real. Religion also helps promote moral discipline within society. We're all fallen. We don't automatically conform our conduct to moral rules, even when we know that they are good for us. But religion helps teach, train, and habituate people to want what is good. It does not do this primarily by formal laws, that is, by coercive power. It does this through moral education and by framing society's informal rules, the customs and traditions which reflect the wisdom and experience of the ages. In other words, religion helps frame a moral culture within society that instills and reinforces moral discipline. I think we all recognize, that over the past 50 years, religion has been under increasing attack. On the one hand, we have seen the steady erosion of our traditional Judeo-Christian moral system and a comprehensive effort to drive it from the public square. On the other hand, we see the growing ascendancy of secularism and the doctrine of moral relativism. By any honest assessment, the consequences of this moral upheaval have been grim. Virtually every measure of social pathology continues to gain ground. In 1965, the illegitimacy rate was 8%. The last time I was Attorney General, in 1992, it was at 25%. Today, it is at over 40%, and that's the national average. In many of our large urban areas, as we know, it is well over 70%. Along with the wreckage of the family, we are seeing record levels of depression and mental illness, dispirited young people, soaring suicide rates, increasing numbers of angry and alienated young males, an increase in senseless violence, and a deadly drug epidemic. As you know, over 70,000 people die a year from drug overdoses. That is more casualties in a year than we experienced during the entire Vietnam War. I won't dwell on the bitter results of the new secular age. Suffice it to say that the campaign to destroy the traditional moral order has coincided, and I believe has brought with it immense suffering and misery. And yet the forces of secularism, ignoring these tragic results, press on with even greater militancy. Among the militant secularists are many so-called progressives. But where is the progress? We are told we are living in a post-Christian era. But what has replaced the Judeo-Christian moral system? What is it that can fill the spiritual void in the hearts of the individual person? And what is the system of values that can sustain human social life? The fact is that no secular creed has emerged capable of performing the role of religion. Scholarship suggests that religion has been integral to the development and thriving of Homo sapiens since we emerged roughly 50,000 years ago.
You are listening to a special edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. You've been listening to the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, who recently spoke to the Notre Dame Law School about the essential nature of religious freedom to America's republic, the attacks that are taking place, and what we must do to defend. Don't go away. We come back with more. News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you happen to miss any of today's special edition of Washington Watch, which is a speech given by the Attorney General of the United States at Notre Dame Law School on the essential nature of religious freedom to our republic, if you miss any of it on your way home, I encourage you to go back and listen to it at TonyPerkins.com. All right, here's the Attorney General continuing.
And it is just for the past few hundred years that we've embarked on this experiment of living without religion. We hear much today about our humane values, but in the final analysis, what undergirds these values? What commands our adherence to them? What we call values today is really nothing more than mere sentimentality, still drawing on the vapor trails of Christianity. Now, there have been times and places where the traditional moral order has been shaken in the past. In the past, societies like the human body seem to have a self-healing mechanism, a self-correcting mechanism that gets things back on course if things go too far. The consequences of moral chaos become too pressing. The opinion of decent people rebels. They coalesce and rally against obvious excess. Periods of moral retrenchment follow periods of excess. This is the idea of the pendulum, and we've all thought to ourselves, after a while, the pendulum will swing back. But today we face something different that may mean that we cannot count on the pendulum swinging back. First is the force, fervor, and comprehensiveness of the assault on organized religion we are experiencing today. This is not decay. This is organized destruction. Secularists and their allies have marshaled all the forces of mass communication, popular culture, the entertainment industry, and academia in an unremitting assault on religion and traditional values. These instruments are used not only to affirmatively promote secular orthodoxy, but also to drown out and silence opposing voices, and to attack viciously and hold up to ridicule any dissidents. One of the ironies, as some have observed, is that the secular project has itself become a religion, pursued with religious fervor. It is taking on all the trappings of religion, including inquisitions and excommunication. Those who defy the creed risk a figurative burning at the stake. Social, educational, and professional ostracism and exclusion waged through lawsuits and savage social media campaigns. The pervasiveness and the power of our high-tech popular culture fuels apostasy in other ways. It provides an unprecedented degree of distraction. Part of the human condition has been that there usually has been no way to avoid the big questions that stare us in the face. Are we created or are we purely material accidents? Does our life have any meaning or purpose? But as Blaise Pascal observed, instead of grappling with these questions, many human beings are easily distracted from thinking about the final things. And indeed, we now live in the age of distraction, where we can envelop ourselves in a world of digital stimulation and universal connectivity. And we have almost limitless ways of indulging all our physical appetites. There's another modern phenomenon that is suppressing society's self-corrective mechanism that's making it harder for us to restore ourselves. In the past, when societies are threatened by moral chaos, the overall social costs of licentiousness and irresponsible personal conduct becomes so high that society ultimately recoils and reevaluates the path it is on. But today, in the face of all the increasing pathologies, instead of addressing the underlying cause, we have cast the state in the role of the alleviator of bad consequences. We call on the state to mitigate the social costs of personal misconduct and irresponsibility. So the reaction to growing illegitimacy is not sexual responsibility, but abortion. The reaction to drug addiction is safe injection sites. The solution to the breakdown of the family is for the state to set itself up as an ersatz husband for the single mother and an ersatz father for the children. The call comes for more and more social programs to deal with this wreckage. And while we think we're solving problems, we are underwriting them. We start with an untrammeled freedom, and we end up as dependents of a coercive state on whom we depend. Interestingly, this idea of the state as the alleviator of bad consequences has given rise to a new moral system that goes hand in hand with the secularization of society. It can be called a system of macro morality, and in some ways it is an inversion of Christian morality. Christianity teaches a micro morality. We transform the world by focusing on our own personal morality and transformation. The new secular religion teaches macro morality. One's morality is not gauged by their private conduct, but rather their commitment to political causes and collective action to address various social problems. This system allows us not to worry so much about the strictures on our own private lives, because we can find salvation on the picket line.
I'm Tony Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch. This is the Attorney General of the United States speaking recently at Notre Dame Law School about religious liberty. We continue after the break.
Today more than ever, there is a need to pass fetal dignity laws. In 2010, the police raided the abortion clinic of Dr. Kermit Gosnell and discovered jars with the remains of unborn babies. In 2019, another abortionist, Dr. Ulrich Klopfer, was exposed for hiding the remains of thousands of unborn babies in plastic bags in the trunk of his old car. And in 2015, videos from the Center for Medical Progress uncovered an industry where aborted baby body parts are being harvested and sold for research. The trafficking of aborted babies funds the abortion industry and incentivizes harmful practices such as late-term abortion, altering abortion methods solely to preserve remains for sale, violating patient privacy, and even killing children born alive in order to harvest their organs. All states should ensure the respectful burial of unborn children killed in abortion and prohibit the sale and trafficking of baby body parts. To learn more about fetal dignity laws, visit frc.org/fetal dignity.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Clausen addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, tonyperkins.com. This has been a special edition of Washington Watch today, something I don't think we've ever done before. Actually airing a speech, not given at an FRC event, but a speech that I think is so important, I wanted to share it with you. It is a speech that the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, gave recently at the Notre Dame Law School about the essential nature of religious freedom. We continue now.
We can signal our finely tuned moral sensibilities by participating in demonstrations on this cause or on that. Something happened recently that crystallized this difference between these competing moral systems. I was attending Mass at a parish I did not usually attend in Washington, D.C. And at the end of Mass, the chairman of the Social Justice Committee got up to give his report to the parish. And he pointed to the growing homeless problem in D.C. and explained that more mobile soup kitchens were needed to feed them. This being a Catholic church, I expected him to call for volunteers to go out and provide for this need as volunteers. But instead, he recounted all the visits that the committee members had made to the D.C. government to lobby for higher taxes and more spending to fund mobile soup kitchens. A third phenomenon which makes it difficult for the pendulum to swing back is the way the law is being used as a battering ram to break down traditional moral values and to establish moral relativism as the new orthodoxy. Law is being used in a couple of ways. First, either through legislation, but more frequently through judicial interpretation, the forces of secularism have been continually seeking to eliminate laws that reflect traditional moral norms. At first, this involved rolling back laws that prohibited certain kinds of conduct, hence the watershed decision legalizing abortion, and since then, the legalization of euthanasia, and the list goes on, as we all know. More recently, we have seen the law used aggressively to force religious people and entities to subscribe to practices and policies that are antithetical to their faith. The problem is not that religion is being forced on others. The problem is that irreligion is being forced. Secular values are being forced on people of faith. This reminds me of the way Roman emperors just couldn't leave the minority of Christians in the empire alone, although they were loyal to the emperor. They couldn't leave them in peace. They would mandate that they had to violate their conscience by offering religious sacrifice to the emperor as a god. Similarly today, militant secularists do not have a live and let live spirit. They are not content to leave religious people alone to practice their faith. Instead, they seem to take delight in compelling people to violate their conscience. For example, the last administration sought to force religious employers, including Catholic religious orders, to violate their sincerely held religious views by funding contraceptive and abortifacient coverage in their health plans. And similarly, recently, California has sought to require pro-life pregnancy centers to provide notices of abortion rights. This refusal to accommodate the free exercise of religion is relatively recent. Just 25 years ago, there was a broad consensus in our society that our laws should accommodate religious belief. In 1993, Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The purpose of the statute was to promote maximum accommodation to religion when the government adopted broad policies that might impinge on religious practice. And at the time, this was not controversial. It was introduced by Chuck Schumer with 170 co-sponsors in the House, and was introduced by Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch with 59 co-sponsors in the Senate, and it passed the Senate by 97-3. But recently, as the process of secularization has accelerated, this statute has come under assault, and the idea of religious accommodation is falling out of favor. Because this administration firmly supports accommodation of religion, the battleground at this time has largely shifted to the states. Some state governments are now attempting to compel religious individuals and entities to subscribe to practices or to espouse viewpoints that are incompatible with their religion. Ground zero for these attacks on religion are the schools. And to me, this is the most serious challenge to religious liberty today. For anyone who has a religious faith, by far the most important part of exercising that faith is teaching that religion to your children, the passing on of the faith. There is no greater gift we can give our children and no greater expression of love. And for the government to interfere in that process is a monstrous invasion of religious liberty. Yet, this is where the battle is being joined, and I see that it is being waged on three fronts. The first front relates to the content of public school curriculum. Many states are adopting curriculum that is incompatible with traditional Judeo-Christian principles, according to which parents are attempting to raise their children. And they often do this without any opt-out provision for religious families. Thus, for example, New Jersey recently passed a law requiring public schools to adopt an LGBT curriculum that many feel is inconsistent with traditional Christian teaching. Similar laws have been passed in California and Illinois. And the Orange County Board of Education in California issued an opinion that, quote, parents who disagree with the instructional material related to gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation may not excuse their children from this instruction. Indeed, in some cases, the schools may not even warn parents about the lessons they plan to teach on controversial subjects relating to sexual behavior and relationships. This puts parents who dissent from the secular orthodoxy to a difficult choice. Try to scrape together enough money to send their kids to private school or homeschooling, or allow their children to be inculcated with messages that they fundamentally reject. The second axis of attack in the realm of education are state policies designed to starve religious schools of generally available funds and encouraging students to choose secular options rather than religious schools. Montana, for example, created a program that provided tax credits to those who donated to a scholarship program that underprivileged students could use to attend private schools. The point of the program was to provide a greater parental and student choice in education and to provide better education to needy youth. But Montana expressly excluded religious-affiliated private schools from the program. And when that exclusion was challenged in courts by parents who wanted to use the scholarship to attend a non-denominational Christian school, the Montana Supreme Court required the state to eliminate the entire program rather than to allow parents to use the scholarships for religious schools. It justified this action by pointing to a provision in the Montana Constitution commonly referred to as the Blaine Amendment. Blaine Amendments, as many of you know, were passed at a time of rampant anti-Catholic animus in this country and typically disqualify religious institutions from receiving any direct or indirect payment from state funds. The case is now in the Supreme Court, and the Department of Justice has filed a brief explaining why Montana's Blaine Amendment violates the First Amendment. Finally, the third kind of assault on religious freedom in education have been recent efforts to use state laws to force religious schools to adhere to secular orthodoxy. For example, right here in Indiana, a teacher sued the Catholic Archbishop of Indianapolis for directing the Catholic schools within his diocese that they could not employ teachers in same-sex marriages because the example of those same-sex marriages would undermine the school's teaching on the Catholic view of marriage and the complementarity of the sexes. This lawsuit clearly infringes on the First Amendment rights of the Archdiocese by interfering both with its expressive association and with its church autonomy. And the Department of Justice filed a statement of interest in the state court making these points, and we hope that the state court will soon dismiss this case. Taken together, these cases paint a disturbing picture. We see the state requiring local public schools to insert themselves into contentious social debates without regard to the religious views of their students or parents. In effect, these states are requiring local communities to make their public schools inhospitable to families with traditional religious values. Those families are implicitly told that they should conform or leave. At the same time, pressure is placed on religious schools to abandon their religious convictions. Simply because of their religious character, they are starved of funds. Students who would otherwise choose to attend them are told that they may only receive scholarships if they turn their sights elsewhere. And simultaneously, religious schools are threatened in tort cases and undoubtedly will be threatened with the denial of accreditation if they adhere to their religious character. If these measures are successful, those with religious convictions will become still more marginalized. I do not mean to suggest that there is no hope for moral renewal in our country, but we cannot sit back and just hope that the pendulum is going to swing back towards sanity. As Catholics, we are committed to the Judeo-Christian values that have made this country great, and we know that the first thing we have to do to promote this renewal is to ensure that we are putting our principles into practice in our own personal lives. We understand that only by transforming ourselves will we transform the world beyond ourselves. This is tough work. It's hard to resist the constant seductions of contemporary society, and this is where we need the grace and prayer and the help of the church. Beyond this, we must place greater emphasis on the moral education of our children. Education is not vocational training. It is leading our children to the recognition that there is truth and helping them develop the facility to discern and love the truth and the discipline to live by it. We cannot have a moral renaissance unless we succeed in passing to the next generation our faith and values in full vigor. The times are hostile to this. Public agencies, including public schools, are becoming secularized and increasingly actively promoting moral relativism. If ever there was a need for a resurgence of Catholic education and more generally religiously affiliated schools, it is today. I think we should do all we can to promote and support authentic Catholic education at all levels. Finally, as lawyers, we should be particularly active in the struggle that is being waged against religion on the legal plane. We must be vigilant to resist efforts by forces of secularization to drive religious viewpoints from the public square and to impinge upon our exercise of our faith. I can assure you that as long as I am Attorney General, the Department of Justice will be at the forefront of this effort, ready to fight for the most cherished of all our American liberties, the freedom to live according to our faith. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today, and God bless you and Notre Dame.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of Washington Watch, a speech by the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, at Notre Dame Law School about the essential nature of religious freedom in America, the nature of the attacks on our first freedom, and how we must protect and defend this essential freedom, even in the face of the growing hostile opposition. That is, if our republic is to survive. The content was powerful, and I felt it was extremely important to share the speech with you, especially in light of the left's apoplectic response. Amazingly, some even claimed that the Attorney General did not know his history and was making up the claim that religious freedom was fundamental to America. I guess we should not be surprised at such claims, given the reality that so-called institutions of higher learning are no longer teaching American history in government. Neither subject apparently provides sufficient safe spaces. Well, here's the bottom line. The way to protect and defend our first freedom, the freedom of religion, is not by locking it away in a vault, but by openly exercising it, thereby making it stronger and more vibrant for all, including future generations. General Barr confirmed what we've been saying since the Obama administration. Public education is ground zero in the attack on religion and religious freedom. Of course, the Attorney General has been viciously criticized by the left for his remarks, as I mentioned, just as I have been when I pointed out that beginning with the removal of prayer and the Bible from our schools, the left began its long march through the institutions of America, leaving a trail of utter destruction. If America's moral foundation is to be restored, it will require people of biblical faith stepping forward in spite of the resistance and opposition that seeks to silence us. It starts in our homes, taking the responsibility God has given us as parents to teach our children and grandchildren the truth. But it doesn't stop there. Government schools funded with our tax dollars are driving a wedge between parents and their children. In some cases, telling children whose parents are teaching them biblical morality that their parents are bigoted, hateful, and narrow-minded. It is time to resist and turn back these attacks on biblical truth that are carrying our children away as captives. It begins with prayer. Prayer for our children, for our families, and our nation. But it doesn't stop there. It's time for bold, courageous action. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.